Now, I personally believe that there's nothing better than a great adventure, whether it's to another country or into the backyard. It can have an amazing ability to change not just the way that we see the world, but also the way that we see ourselves. That is exactly what you're going to hear about from our incredible guests. On Great Adventures, I'm going to be hanging out with actors, athletes, thought leaders, and of course explorers, some old friends and some new, to discuss how being adventurous benefited their lives. My name is Charles Thorpe. For over a decade, I've been chasing down epic stories professionally for magazines and television shows, and now I'm bringing those conversations here. Growing up, I loved reading the books and watching the movies of legendary underwater explorer Jacques Cousteau. A few years back, I had the pleasure of meeting his grandson, the Emmy-nominated host Philippe Cousteau Jr., who's continuing that legacy by both documenting our oceans and protecting them. As you can imagine, he has quite a few great stories. I just had to have him by the studio at Smile Radio, located in Smile to Go at the Freehand Hotel, to share them. Come check it out. Thanks so much for being here, man. How are you feeling today?
I am having a terrific day. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. To start this off with, just talking about the latest adventure you had. So what was the last one for you that really changed your perspective on life?
You know, I had the opportunity this summer to actually go to the Red Sea.
Oh, amazing.
And it was in Saudi Arabia, actually, which has been in the news a lot lately for a lot of the wrong reasons. But there's some interesting conservation work that's going on there as well. And so I was out there, we were doing some filming, because the Red Sea holds a dear place in my heart. It was one of the first places that my grandfather, Jacques Cousteau, my father, Philippe Sr., went to filming in the early first underwater documentaries ever, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And they spent a lot of time there. I've been there filming with BBC and a few other productions over the years. And so getting to go, though, to Saudi Arabia is very rare because they don't have tourism, essentially. And so I got to go along the coast and dive on what are some of the last truly spectacular coral reefs on Earth. And I always tell people, if there's a Garden of Eden on Earth, it is a Red Sea coral reef. And because there's very little development along the coast of Saudi Arabia, the reefs there are absolutely incredible. And because of its geography, where it is, what makes it really unique is that climate change has not really affected the reefs along the coast of Saudi Arabia in the way that they have. Or it has in Australia, the Coral Triangle, and other places, because the Red Sea historically was so hot and is so hot that the corals have adapted to water that's 82, 83, 84, 85 degrees that would kill coral elsewhere. So the coral there is thriving.
That's
where
amazing.
Coral's collapsing everywhere else. And we got to go and film that. And it was brought tears to my eyes, because a year before that, I'd been at the Great Barrier Reef, which is just so awful.
Last nights, right? Yeah.
It's terrible. And to see a place that is still thriving was really amazing.
I think we talked actually while you were out there, and you were taking the boat out to the Red Sea, and you were out there doing your work. And you'd mentioned to me you think that maybe there's a secret for saving our coral out in the Red Sea. Do you still believe that? And, you know, where is that secret? What could that possibly be?
Well, there's a lot of interesting research that's being done that's all about, why are these corals resilient? And, you know, some people ask me, well, can we take the corals in the Red Sea and, you know, release them into the Great Barrier Reef or somewhere?
Right.
And you can't, because technically that's an invasive species and you don't want to introduce species into new areas that may carry disease or not have predators. You never know exactly how it can upset the ecosystem. But in this case, the research is looking at genetically, how are these corals resilient in the face of climate change? What are the triggers that are allowing them to thrive in warm water? And perhaps could that be engineered or bred into other corals in other places? Is that possible? So there's, yeah, you're right. It could hold the key for the hope of the future of coral reefs. And it's really exciting to go and see a place like this where there's hopeful news amidst all the bad news that exists today that we hear about all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that there isn't really any tourism there as far as where you were going. But if somebody wanted to dive out there and get that experience, is there any way to get to sort of, you know, somewhere comparable in that area? Obviously, they want to travel there themselves and they're not, you know, Philippe Cousteau.
It's starting, actually. There is some efforts to start to build some tourism along that coast. And we've been asked by some of those groups to try and help them do a better job with respect to the reefs. So I'm on an advisory board of some really amazing folks that are saying, listen, you've got an incredible asset here. It's going to only grow in value because as coral reefs elsewhere decline.
Exactly.
These scarce reefs that are healthy will be a treasure of the world. So if you're going to build in a way that doesn't destroy them, because this is your greatest asset.
Absolutely.
So it's coming. In the next few years, you will be able to visit these places.
And I think it's great that they're being preventative about these sort of things. I feel like so often tourism boroughs are late to the punch.
Yeah.
They're closing islands after they're already decimated or littered with trash. Tell me a little bit about growing up in the Cousteau family. I mean, did you always know you're going to be diving? Did you always know this was going to be where you'd end up?
Well, you know, when I was little, I wanted to be a fireman. You know, I didn't. My grandfather was an amazing global explorer, filmmaker.
I mean, you can't say, you know, the list goes on and on. You know, filmographer, cinematographer. Yeah,
is a writer, author. You know, and actually, what people forget is that this year is the 75th anniversary of when my grandfather co-invented scuba diving. And it's also
just
been 75
little
years.
Thing of, yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's remarkable, and I think it's hard for people to imagine that when my grandfather was young, nobody knew really anything about the oceans. Mm-hmm. All we knew was what we pulled out in nets and what we dumped in trash. There were no images of sharks and reefs and fish, and there was no Nemos, there were no, you know, Shamus, none of that stuff. And so it's really only in 75 years that we've begun to understand what exists beneath the waves. Mm. Unfortunately, it's also in that time, post-World War II, that we've seen the greatest amount of destruction of our oceans. So growing up with that legacy had a huge influence on me, of course. But it wasn't really until I was 16 that I had a trip that really galvanized my idea that, wow, yeah, I this is what I want to do.
Let's talk a little bit about that trip, because it just sounds epic. Papua New Guinea, right?
Yep.
Is that what you were 16?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, go on.
So I was I had the opportunity to go to Papua New Guinea, which is just an island nation north of Australia. And I was out there with a woman named Dr. Eugenie Clark, who was a visionary leader, one of the first female oceanographers. And she was conducting research in the southeastern part of the country for about 2 weeks. And so I flew out there, got to join her crew and do science with her and the other folks that were there for about 2 weeks.
How were your skills at this point as far as diving?
Good diving skills. I was given a camera and a log that you could write underwater. And we were tasked essentially with photographing and observing a fish, Hoplolotus filamentosus, I think is its scientific name, a sand diving
I won't
fish.
Be able to tell you whether or not that's right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So as far, you can say whatever.
As far as you know.
People will Google it later, but I have no idea.
So it was a sand diving fish, and they would build little burrows in the sand. And so for an hour at a time on the dive, you just sit there and watch them and record their behavior. And so we did this for 2 weeks all over this area. And you'd be out on this small boat, live aboard, and the locals had very little exposure to Western culture at the time, even today. And they would be coming out in dugout canoes to trade fruit and whatever they were growing for rice. And the kids always wanted a little piece of candy.
Of course.
We brought school supplies for them, pencils and crayons and paper, etc. But it was, I mean, these people lived in grass huts and in very, very remote parts of the world. And so it felt like Indiana Jones. I mean, I was there, we were on dugout canoes, we were hiking up into caves that had go back hundreds and hundreds of years, filled with skulls of ceremonial burial sites and sacrifice sites that had, you know, these culture had gone back so far in time. I remember I was snorkeling with saltwater crocodiles and sharks, and just it was amazing, scary and wonderful, and at that point I thought to myself, wow, this is definitely the kind of thing that I want to dedicate my life to.
Now, what were some of the other adventures? And as far as, you know, obviously your father was an amazing cinematographer and created a lot of films. Did you study his work? Did you study your grandfather's work before you started going down this field?
I did. I used to watch a lot of my father and grandfather's films. You know, my grandfather left such a rich legacy of and a body of work behind, dozens of documentaries and films and books My father produced 26 of my grandfather's most famous documentaries. He produced, directed, and filmed so many of them. He was my grandfather's right hand for so many years until, unfortunately, he died in an airplane accident in 1979 when he was 39 years old. And I'm 39 this year myself. And he died 6 months before I was born. So I never knew my father. But I grew up with an amazing mother who raised my sister Alexandra and myself and really inspired us to continue and to believe in that legacy. And of course, my grandfather's words. And I remember one story, the second half of the trip to Papua New Guinea, we went up to the highlands. Again, a place with tribes, very little exposure to Western culture, still living in grass huts and hunting with bows and arrows and grass skirts and you know, boar tusks and feathers in their noses and these ornate wigs that they would grow over time. So they're called the Huli Wigmen. And I remember my grandfather growing up had always told me that we are all connected by these golden threads in the world, that a valuable lesson, no matter who you are and where you live, you're connected to others everywhere. That the actions that we take, particularly in the United States, be it through consumption and waste or politics or, you know, whatever, economically, has impacts and ripple effects around the world. I remember walking down a little trail one day with our guide. And I saw a group of tribesmen walking towards us from a hunt in the forest. And there were probably a dozen of them. Several of them were the older, kind of more mature men in the front. And then it went down as the boys got younger in the back. And they were wearing their grass skirts and had their bow and arrows and spears and were barefoot, of course, and bare-chested. And I remember walking along, and as I passed each one of these men, they'd seen some tourists and some people come through, and they all nodded. They were all very nice and friendly, though there are some cannibals in that area, some cannibalistic tribes in that area, but not them. And so,
now, did you know that before?
I did. I did. I was aware. So we wanted to stay.
The tour guide was adept at
one region. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, we're going in this area, not in the area over there.
That's good. That's a good map.
It's definitely helpful. You want to go and not be lunch on a trip. That's a good policy. General policy: don't get eaten when you're on an adventure.
Hot tips.
Exactly. In case that wasn't self-evident, note to everybody: try not to get eaten.
If you take anything away from this podcast, take that away, please.
Please don't become a meal. And so we, I remember there was the young boy, he's probably 15 or 16, at the back of the group. He had bare feet and a grass skirt, a bow and arrow. And then he was wearing a Lakers t-shirt. And I was shocked. I was born in LA. And I just couldn't believe this. Here we are in one of the most remote places in the world. And this young man, clearly someone had given it to him, had a Lakers t-shirt on. And it just reminded me of my grandfather there on my shoulder saying, you know, the golden threads were all connected. And that really stuck with me, that experience. I can still see it today. And again, was that kind of one of those aha moments that said, wow, we are connected. The choices, the consequences of our actions are felt around the world. And we need to be making better choices because the world, even then, you know, this is 1996, is in a lot of trouble. And things have, unfortunately, mostly gotten worse.
Yeah. Now, having that that base of operations in Los Angeles, in having that contrast between this trip, you know, tell me a little bit about what it was like to go back home and hang out with your friends then. I mean, you know, what did you learn from, okay, these people haven't had this experience, so they haven't seen this part of the world, and how can I broadcast that?
It was very impactful for me, absolutely, this idea of what I was able to see and do as a young person growing up. And you know, I think of anything that influenced me in life, it's not because of my birth certificate that I'm a Cousteau, it's because of good teaching. And my grandfather was a great teacher, my mother was a great teacher, I had great teachers growing up. And so fundamentally, I'm a product of that. And I realized that if we want to change the world, that we need to figure out how we engage and spread that inspiration to people. And so while a lot of people can't go to Papua New Guinea, through Earth Echo International, we've developed a lot of resources and tools to get people, young people, outdoors into their own communities, because you can have adventures out your back door. You don't have to go halfway around the world. You can discover new things. We worked with a lot of kids in Miami, for example, from parts of Miami, kids in middle school that have never been to the beach, never been into the water before. Same in Los Angeles, same all over. So there are amazing adventures to be had just out your back door. And that's really what we're all about, is how do we provide resources and tools to engage kids, young people in particular, to just understand that this world is an amazing place and that we all have to be active participants in protecting and enhancing it.
Our first partner in this is Hanna One, breakthrough nutrition supplements with Ayurvedic and Bhutanese medicine. I was first introduced to them a while back by climbing photographer extraordinaire Jimmy Chin. He handed me one of their Go Packs during a hang, and I've been hooked ever since. They're always in my backpack, whether I'm hiking or just running around the city. Now they're offering our crew a special deal if you go to hannahlife.com/adventure. That's hannahlife.com/adventure. I just did a story actually on the Everglades, and it was fascinating to me how many people who live in Miami or go to Miami never take a step into the Everglades, which is such a beautiful, biodiverse. I mean, seeing that happening throughout the world and being like, okay, yeah, you can go to Paris, you can go to Venice, you can go to all these places, but just, you know, 2-3 hours away, you might see something that's going to change your life.
Yeah, I mean, just outside of so many of these cities, Miami's a great example. Actually, you mentioned the Everglades. I lived in Florida for a couple years. My first documentary that I wrote and produced and filmed was on the Everglades.
That's amazing.
It is an amazing place. It's a third the size of what it used to be. It's a shadow, really, of its former self. I don't want to get doom and gloom, but the Everglades is a cautionary tale, if nothing else. It's kind of a bit of a depressing tale when you look at it of what happens when we put short-term development and economic gain in front of the long-term health of ecosystems. The irony is that you know, for a long time, people saw the Everglades as just a big swamp to be drained. And yet it's the Everglades that is the primary source of water into the Biscayne Aquifer, which provides most of the drinking water for southern Florida. It's the Everglades is an amazing place. It's a great example, but all over the world, here in New York, there's terrific work that's happening along the Hudson River to restore that place to its former glory. The water quality has increased a tremendous amount over the last few decades. Groups like the Waterkeeper Alliance and others have done such terrific work there. And there's a lot of schools engaging, and there's the Billion Oyster Project. You know, there's so many different things that are happening just outside our back door, no matter where we are. I was recently in the Cuyahoga River Valley in Ohio a year ago. This is the river that helped spark the Earth Day movement, really galvanize environmental action around the country when it was on fire. There's famous images back from the, you know, decades ago, when this river burned, because there's a lot of industry along the coast, the shores of the river, and they would just dump all the chemicals in the water. And this spurred one of the things that really inspired Richard Nixon, a Republican who founded the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and so many other things. So it's atrocious that the Republican Party has decided that somehow, for some reason, conservation is ridiculous.
I mean, every issue should be bipartisan.
Yeah, talking about a bipartisan one, right? Clean air and clean water. But I was there a year ago, and they're close to being designated as a clean river by EPA standards. They've just this year been designated a nationally historic kind of scenic river.
That's tremendous progress.
It's tremendous progress. And that's really because of people in the local community, young people, schools, and politicians who responded to the demands of the public that we can't let this happen anymore. Because let's face it, a politician's number one job is to get reelected. So I always tell people, if you care about the environment, vote for that.
Absolutely. Use your voice.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about finding your own voice. Obviously, your family had its way, had its films. Your father had his films. Your grandfather had his films. But you've sort of taken that legacy and then turned into something different in this new digital age of TV. Tell me how you found your, you know, way in front of a camera hosting. Did that feel natural? Did it feel organic?
You know, at first, it terrified me. But it's just something
that terrifies most sane people.
Yes,
I feel
you know, what is it? People rate public speaking like as a greater fear than death.
Yeah, that's the famous saying: is nonsense, they'd rather be given the eulogy than being in the casket. Yeah, exactly. Or no, rather be in the casket
than given the eulogy. Yeah.
Flip that around.
You know, it's true, and I bless and credit my mother for this, because when I went to Papua New Guinea, I'd take an extra week off of school during spring break. And this is my number one advice to kids, to do what my mother did to me. She said, in order for me to get permission for you from school to do that, they said that you have to come. And I told them that I want you to have to come back to school and give a presentation to your class and then give a presentation to a local community group about your trip. Terrified. But doing it started me on this path of getting used to it. And now it doesn't faze me. And so that was important in my development. I always tell my number one advice to any young person that I talk to is take a class in public speaking, get up in front of people, learn how to sell your ideas.
It should be in every school. It should be mandatory.
In every
absolutely.
School. It's a skill that you can use forever.
Yeah,
it's in
universal.
A boardroom or in an interview, whatever you do for a living, mm-hmm. you should be able to communicate. And so often, especially these days, kids are really good at texting. And, you know, looking down at their phones instead of looking up out of the world.
Exactly.
So it's my number one advice. But
absolutely.
My mom was really great in forcing me to do that.
And eye contact.
Eye contact.
You're
very
good with
important.
Eye contact. I just had to mention because I noticed that.
Just don't avoid people's eye looking down. You know, it's a real big issue, actually. And we do a lot of communications training, media training with young people that we work with.
That's
to
great.
Try and help them understand how to do that. But the key then was also for me a very different media landscape than when my grandfather was around. You know, when he started out, there were 6 or 7 channels on television. Now there's 1,000. There's the internet, and you're competing with social media and all these different siloed experiences. When my grandfather's show was on television on Sunday, that was it. Like, there were that was like one of the only shows to watch. So you capture millions and millions and millions of people to watch this. Now you have so many different choices that are tailored to different consuming and viewing habits that for us, it's diversifying the media experience that is the real challenge, I think, today to break through with this kind of a message. And so we believe we have to be doing virtual reality. We have to be on television in scripted. We're working on some scripted projects, some animated projects. I've got a new book series that I'm doing with HarperCollins for tweens and teens. I had an elementary school book that we did a few years ago for young kids. We have to be in the classroom. We have to be on radio. We're looking at graphic novels. We have to be in so many different places to reach any kind of an audience. That's the big challenge, I think, today for those of us in the storytelling and communication conservation space, is we can't just do a documentary series and go, oh, great, job's done, because we reach a tiny segment of the audience.
Yeah,
we have to really diversify our offering and how we tell the stories that we want to tell.
Yeah, but I think it's also exciting because it's a bit of a wild west out there, and you're able to tell stories in a more complete fashion. And yeah. You know, people are consuming by so many different ways, whether it's a podcast, a TV show. A little clip on social media that leads them to that podcast, that leads them to a TV show.
Indeed.
There's a lot of funnels there, which is you can capture that attention in a little more provocative way. Maybe it's not as long, but it's intense, you know, and it riles something out of them. You mentioned the VR thing that you have here at Tribeca. Let's talk a little bit about that.
So I remember one time when I was in New York visiting my grandfather many years ago. I think it was probably around 1989, 1990. Game Boy had just come out. Now this was like the original handheld gaming thing, right? And the screen was so small. Do you remember this? They sold an attachment that was a magnifying glass.
I do remember that.
Black and white. I had it too. But it was the hottest thing for kids back then. I mean, today kids would look at that and like laugh in your face, but back then
totally.
It was the thing. Screen was so small, it was like an inch by an inch. It was tiny, but it was the coolest thing ever.
Of course.
And I remember I was having dinner with my grandfather, and so I was about 9 or 10 at the time, And halfway through dinner, he looked over me and he's like, so what about this Game Boy? And these were the magic words for a kid my age. And I was like, what? So my grandfather would have been like 79 at the time. And he had one, was playing Tetris, Super Mario Bros. And we started talking about Game Boy. I couldn't believe it.
I just want a clip of that. I'm sorry. I know it's your grandfather.
But like, oh, the wisdom. And I remember the thing that he said to me was, you know, he was always amazed by technology, always embracing new technology, which is how many 79-year-olds have like the latest like handheld gaming device?
Not many.
Typically, as we get older, we kind of, you know,
revert
and don't want this new technology. He was the opposite. He really loved technology. And I remember he said to me, he said, you know, Philippe, this is not just a tool for entertainment, but these are the tools that we must embrace for education and inspiration. And that stuck with me. And so we're always looking for what are the technologies that exist out there and how can we embrace those as a new means to engage people. And virtual reality is really exciting. So we are announcing or launching tomorrow morning, Tribeca Interactive, actually, a program called Drop in the Ocean. And it's a VR, shared VR experience where several, 3 to 4 or 5 people in a curated space come together. It's not for home use. It's for, exactly. That's probably a version come down in a year or two. Just because the resolution isn't there, the tech isn't quite there yet.
Of course.
But it's for like science centers. It's going to premiere. It premieres at Tribeca Interactive, and then it's going to go to the California Academy of Sciences and then all over the world. What's really exciting about it is that it shrinks the viewer, the participants down to roughly about 1 or 2 inches in size relative to the world around them. And so we then send them deep into the ocean so that microscopic plankton that most people don't even know exists is all of a sudden like enormous and floating past you. And my wife, Ashlyn, and I are the hosts and walk people through this 7 or 8 minute experience. And then some microplastic floats by and they get to see like this thing that you almost wouldn't be able to see with the naked eye and understand that every 2 out of every 3 breaths come from plankton in the ocean, not the rainforest, not the Amazon. It comes from the ocean. And so I love these technologies because it gives us an opportunity to change the way people can interact and relate to the world around them through technology. And so we're really excited about Drop in the Ocean because it's nothing like this exists. And I think it will really help people open people's eyes to just a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what a great learning tool. And I think, you know, for me personally, VR has never had too much appeal because I know a lot of travel companies who try to use that to show you their newest bungalow or not. I'd rather feel the breeze myself. I'm sorry. I'd rather feel the waves, you know, lapping on my feet. Now, this is a little different because it shows a completely different perspective.
Like you could and never have this experience, right?
100%.
And that's what's exciting about it to me. Exactly.
That's really cool. Now, let's talk a little bit about the shows. You have a long-running show. Mm-hmm. You're doing your next season of, and then you also have a couple of projects that you can sort of talk about but can't fully talk about. But let's talk about your show first.
So Awesome Planet start filming the 6th season of that coming up here. We just got nominated for our 4th Emmy.
Congratulations, by the way.
It's terrific. Thank you.
I feel like saying Emmy nominated is almost as good as saying Emmy winning.
I feel like you get a lot of distance out of that, for sure.
I mean, I want the statue for you, of course, because I think you deserve it, but I think it sounds just as good, personally.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor, and you know, people love the show, and it's Saturday morning, so it really hits a family audience, particularly young people, but I know a lot of folks. The families get together and watch it, and it's syndicated all over the country, actually internationally. And it's a half-hour show, and it's just about how the world works. The natural history, nature. We go everywhere from diving with bull sharks in Fiji to climbing glaciers in Alaska to, you know, working with marine biologists in Florida. So we get to see how the world works. We go all over the world. It's such a fun show. So we start filming that coming up here soon, and that airs Saturday mornings on most local Fox affiliates across the country, sometimes on Tribune or NBC's, but most of the local Fox stations carry it.
Are those destinations locked down? I mean, where are you looking forward to going to?
Yeah, we're looking at Africa this year, actually. Oh, we haven't done Africa yet. So that's really, really exciting. We've done Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and Fiji, and plenty of places in we've done Croatia. We've done a bunch of places in the Caribbean. But we're looking at Africa as kind of our big destination this year. So we're going to start filming that here late summer, early fall, I think. And then we are working on a big network series, ocean series. I can't say much more than that. We're just in negotiations right now. But that's really exciting and going to be like the next big ocean series on television. So trying to stay busy. And, you know, my big adventure in 5 weeks, I'm having a baby girl. So that's the whole next generation for me. And so I'm going to try and manage the travel over the next few months to a dull roar so that I can be home as much as possible. But
now that's amazing. I mean, we're going to get on that a little bit more, but I want to talk about vacation ideas. You know, summer's coming up, fall's coming up, you know, the hits obviously come to top of mind, but what are some of the places you would want to steer people to, you know, avoid that over tourism, avoid some of the crowds and get out there and engage with nature in a real way?
Nature, this country, you know, they say that the two greatest inventions of the United States is jazz and national parks. I agree.
It's National Parks Week right now, absolutely.
So I tell people, and there are national, it's, you know, everybody thinks Yosemite and they think Yellowstone, which are absolutely spectacular. Glacier, my goodness, go before the glaciers are gone. But there are national parks all over the place. You know, in New England, I mean, you have that whole Adirondack Range, you know, up in Maine, we've been up in Maine. So anywhere in the United States, you are not far from a national reserve, a national park. That's my recommendation to people. People think of, you know, Disneyland or Disney World and all this stuff. Nonsense. Go outside, go outdoors, go have an experience that you'll remember for the rest of your life. And that those are the experiences you have in nature. And we are so lucky and fortunate in this country to have such an amazing national park system with so many dedicated people that make it happen under very trying times, particularly under the current political climate, with funds, you know, funding for those kinds of things getting slashed all the time. I say go and enjoy your national parks.
That's, support it. Absolutely.
That's my number one advice.
Now, summer people are always looking for the beaches as well, and I try to steer them away from Miami. Obviously, Caribbean in Puerto Rico has a special place in my own heart. But where in the Caribbean, where would you want to steer them as far as wildlife is concerned?
Puerto Rico definitely needs the tourism right now. Mm-hmm. It's such amazing people. We filmed there for Caribbean Pirate Treasure, this series we did a couple of seasons of on Travel Channel. Love Puerto Rico. You know, a place that a lot of people don't know about is Dominica. Not the Dominican Republic, because a lot of people confuse the two, but Dominica.
I've heard about it, but haven't been, yeah.
Amazing. So they say it's the only island that Christopher Columbus would recognize today. Because it's so mountainous.
That's a pretty cool. That's a good tagline.
It's a pretty cool tagline.
Yeah, who came up with that?
It's genius. Yeah. Because what happened is most of the Caribbean islands were essentially deforested for plantations, for sugarcane, predominantly sugarcane, but also some cotton and rice, things like that. Dominica was not, because it's so mountainous, you can't really grow any large-scale kind of crops like that, right? Lots of fruit grow on the mountainsides and things. So it wasn't. It avoided the deforestation that has plagued so many of the other islands. And so it's this emerald green, beautiful gem. One waterfall for every day of the year. We filmed for Caribbean Pirate Treasure there, and the people are amazing. The place is amazing. At one time, it was an English colony, then a French colony, but it wasn't really valuable to them from an economic perspective, so it kept changing hands and never really got overdeveloped. It was hammered by one of the bad hurricanes a few years ago.
Right. I think that's when I heard about it, actually.
It needs help.
They were doing some work to restore it. Yeah.
It needs visitors, needs people to go. You know, tourism is the largest voluntary transfer of wealth in the history of humanity from rich to poor. And it can be an incredible source of opportunity and hope. It can also be a terribly detrimental thing to places if it's not done sustainably. But Dominica is an amazing place. And that's my number one destination in the Caribbean to recommend people to go and visit. It's fabulous.
Do you have a place that you remember staying or a meal you remember having?
I know that the place that we stayed in was completely leveled in the hurricane. I don't know if they were able to rebuild it or not. But there's, you know, there's not a huge offering. It doesn't have the big, you know, chain hotels on the beaches and things like that, which I think is nice.
Good.
Exactly. Yes. It's a mix of kind of French cuisine and British influences. So the food is great. And when we left the airport, we were driving to the hotel. I remember talking to our tour guide, as we had a big crew with us and we were filming, how much I love mangoes and bananas and fresh fruit. And he's like, well, here it's everywhere. And so we get out and I look and I see all these mangoes all over the street. And I'm like, whoa. What's going on? Like, are people like throwing mangoes out or what's happening? He's like, no. Those are all wild. You see this whole mountainside. He's like, look up. And it's just mango trees as far as the eye can see, full of ripe, glistening fruit, banana trees, papaya.
So he cut down on food costs.
Yeah, obviously. Literally, he was just like, here, he just picked one up and gave it to me. And I'm like, are you kidding me? What is going on here?
Who needs lunch?
Here yeah. Oh, it's so fantastic. It's such a fantastic place. And the people are so wonderful. Dominica.
Before the mics came up, we were talking a little about your next trip to Fiji. Let's talk a little bit about that.
So we're going to Fiji. We're doing an event out there with the Big Dive, kind of to bring awareness to conservation in oceans and coral reefs that I'm hosting. And that is my last trip before baby. We call her Baby Fish. I was just on the Tonight Show on Monday, and we announced her name is Vivian, but we still call her Baby Fish.
Where does that name come from? Is it just one that you both liked?
It's just one we liked. Yeah. That it had to work in French and English. Vivienne,
of course.
And so we both just really like Vivian. And
you got married in Paris, correct?
We did get married in Paris, in the same little mayor's office where my father and my grandparents got married.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So we were married in Paris, and so we wanted a French name for the little girl. So that's that. Like I said, that's the real next big adventure. My dad always said, "Adventure is where you live a full life," and I think. Having a new generation is going to be the best adventure of all.
That's a great note to end on right there. I love that. Thanks so much for being here, man. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, man.
Thanks for listening, guys. If you like what you heard, hit subscribe and leave a quick review on iTunes. Suggest it to a friend who could use a little travel inspiration. If you have a travel question or suggestion on someone I should chat with, just hit me up on my social channels at Charles Thorpe and at Adventure Podcast. New episodes will be dropping every Friday, so keep checking in for the next. Until then, safe travels.